From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In our first half hour, Hugh Weinbrenner and Dennis Goldford talk about the new edition of their book, The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event. They'll tell us why Iowa is important because it goes first, rather than being first because it is important. Then in the second half hour, as hundreds of Iowa soldiers prepare to spend the holidays away from loved ones in support of U.S. military operations abroad, I talk with Army Sergeant Dennis Crosser of North Liberty. Crosser is currently deployed in Iraq. He was also deployed in Iraq in 2004. He'll describe the difference between then and now. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As my first guests this hour point out in their book, people in other parts of the country are occasionally confused as to Iowa's location on the map. But political reporters in the National Press Corps have no difficulty pinpointing the state. Political observers recognize Iowa as a weather vane in presidential politics. And whether you were aware of it or not, we are ramping up into another caucus campaign year before the actual caucus date in January of 2012. This hour, we want to look at how the Iowa precinct caucuses began, how they've changed, and in the words of my guests, how they've been manipulated to become a national media event. Hugh Weinbrenner and Dennis Goldford are the authors of The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event, just published in its third edition by the University of Iowa Press. Hugh Weinbrenner is an emeritus professor of public administration at Drake University. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, and as I'm sure you're aware, a frequent guest on the Exchange Politics Day on Wednesdays. Hugh and Dennis, welcome to our program.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
You write that it was a political accident in the early 1970s that propelled Iowa into this first-in-the-nation position. Tell us what happened.
Well, Iowa decided to move its caucus date forward to comply with party rules that required, Democratic Party rules, that required a month between events, that is, the precinct caucuses, county conventions, district conventions, state convention, and so forth. And as they did this and moved the date back, they discovered that they were now the first nominating event in the country. And although the party people say they didn't realize what they were doing, it didn't take them long to realize what they had done and to attempt to capitalize on it.
And Iowa's status as first in the nation had to be defended many times in the preceding decades, correct?
Absolutely. Most states argue that, as we do in the book, of course, that Iowa is not the most representative state in the union. It has a very relatively low minority population. It's much more agricultural than many states, although not as much as sometimes reporters think we are. But as we make the point in the book, when you have a serial nomination system with one state going after another, somebody's got to be first, and by tradition, Iowa's first, and until everybody who doesn't like that fact can agree on an acceptable alternative, Iowa's likely to remain first.
Dennis Goldford, you write in the book, the both of you write that strictly speaking, the caucuses do not produce meaningful results, and that the results are, quote, contrived by Iowa parties to portray a desired picture of the process. Explain what you mean there.
Well, the purpose of precinct caucuses historically has been to discuss the issues of the day and bring those forth to the county convention and to select delegates to the county convention. There was never any real voting that took place like there is in a primary election, and so consequently the caucuses don't have meaningful results. And the parties had to come up with some way of explaining what happened. And those are the contrived results that we talk about.
1-866-780-9100 if you have a question or a comment as we discuss the Iowa caucuses. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Now, the debate for many years, of course, has been whether Iowa, and you touched on this, should have this much power as a state, not as representative perhaps as of the diversity of the United States as a whole, as it could be, should have this much nomination and power in this process. How much influence does Iowa actually have?
What Iowa tends to do, as Hugh and I have argued for years, is create a situation in which every candidate has the same opponent, and that opponent's name is expected. And the question is, did the candidate do better than expected, and therefore get some media buzz from this media event, as Hugh has always called it, or did the candidate do worse than expected, which throws questions into the viability of a candidate or a campaign? And so what this can do, what the caucuses provide in a sense, is a way for candidates to test out that car on the track. By the car, I mean the candidate, the campaign, and the message, see how well it runs around the track, and see if there are any particular unexpected strengths or weaknesses that observers around the country take note of.
Mm-hmm. In this third edition of your book, it has been updated to include the elections of 2000, 2004, 2008, with the surprise emergence of Barack Obama in the Iowa caucuses ahead of Hillary Clinton. So let's talk about these most recent Iowa caucuses and see what they tell us about how they've developed and the Iowa caucus as an institution and the role it plays. Now, in 2000, as you point out, 2000 saw the first winner of the Iowa caucuses to reach the White House since Jimmy Carter in 1976. That was, of course, George W. Bush in 2000. Since there was this 24-year period, this gap, without a caucus winner making it to the White House, was there the feeling prior to 2000 that the Iowa caucuses weren't really that influential anymore?
You know, it depends on who's observing the process. In a sense, the caucuses have been an opportunity for candidates, but more often than not, it's been a place where campaigns ended. On the other hand, it gained its fame because it catapulted Jimmy Carter all the way to the White House in 1976. So you have the reality versus the perception, and the perception early was that Iowa made presidential candidates. The reality was Iowa eliminated presidential candidates. Perhaps Dennis can talk a little bit about the most recent caucuses, because they have changed that somewhat.
Sure. We had a situation, of course, on both sides in which we had open nominations. There was no incumbent on either side. And in a way, of course, Rudy Giuliani demonstrated that really you need to run either in Iowa or New Hampshire, if not both, to start to get some traction, because he did neither and started and ended in Florida. But the eventual Republican winner, John McCain, himself never seriously contested Iowa. On the Democratic side, of course, the question was who was going to become the un-Hillary, as I used to call that candidate. In other words, Hillary Clinton was the dominant candidate in 2007. The question was who would emerge as her strongest opponent for the Democratic nomination. And certainly, well before we knew about private difficulties on his part, John Edwards was expected to be that un-Hillary. But Barack Obama emerged as the un-Hillary, knocking off Edwards and, of course, leading to the withdrawal of Senators Biden and Dodd and showing nobody else was going to be competitive. So, again, what Iowa does is set the field for what occurs later. We saw that very definitely in 2008, combined with the vast increase of new voters into the process, especially younger and minority voters, and the increase in the use of the Internet as an organizing and fundraising tool.
To what extent did Barack Obama's success becoming the un-Hillary in the Iowa caucuses have to do with his campaign's understanding of how to approach the Iowa caucuses compared to his the other candidates?
Well, to a great extent, of course, Edwards knew that already. He had been through the process. So it's not as though Edwards didn't understand the process.
Mm-hmm. So maybe another way of asking it, too, is let's say you are campaign advisors for a dark horse candidate in the 2012 race. What are the key tips you are going to give this person about the best approach, the do and do not list?
Well, certainly Obama showed Iowa and the nation that you can use a variety of techniques to turn out your supporters for the caucuses. And he really introduced in a big way, the use of the Internet and fundraising via small donors. And he turned out more people for the caucuses than we have ever seen before. We had a very enhanced turnout for the 2008 caucuses. So I think the message was use modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting question for 2012 on the Republican side is that while we would ordinarily, with good reason, assume that potentially viable caucus candidates need to make all these local connections with local campaign officials, party activists, and organizations, the interesting question would be if Sarah Palin runs, of course, then there's the question of who becomes the un-Sarah or the un-Palin because she's so dominant. But the interesting question would be whether she, in fact, gets on the ground and meets all these activists, as she's not done yet, or whether, in fact, she can try using the technology that you described through Twitter and Facebook to organize and motivate her supporters that way. That would change the nature of the caucuses, I think, significantly.
Well, she chose Iowa. She'd made several visits to Iowa recently, most recently on her latest book tour. Is this the behavior of someone planning to run for president and making a testing the waters in Iowa?
Well, typically we see potential candidates coming into the state 2 to 3 years before the actual caucuses, making the rounds, visiting with the local politicals, attempting to determine if they might have some support, attempting to determine if they could raise money. And so this is a very normal process that's going on right now. I might add one thing to what Dennis said. The Republican caucuses tend to be skewed toward the right.
Very much.
Somewhere between 35% and 40% of Republican caucus participants in Iowa are evangelicals or Christian right, as I have referred to them at times.
And this would favor Sarah Palin, would it not?
People like Huckabee, Sarah Palin, yes.
Mm-hmm. And away from the moderates.
A moderate has a very, very difficult time in Iowa, and I think that's why McCain skipped Iowa. Of course, he had specific issues such as ethanol and past fights with Iowa Republicans. But, yes, it's very difficult for a moderate to come in and do well in Iowa, although Bush certainly was, I think, viewed as a moderate, Bush the Younger, when he ran.
Mm-hmm. So you've identified for Sarah Palin a strength in that she is seen in a good light by the evangelicals who tend to turn out for Republican caucuses in the state. What will be her other strengths or perhaps her weaknesses in Iowa if she chooses to run?
There are Republicans certainly who are social and religious conservatives who might like various aspects of Sarah Palin, but are pragmatic enough to be concerned about whether in fact she could actually win a general election if she won the nomination. So that's a concern. One of the arguments within the Republican Party during this midterm cycle, of course, is whether the party should return to more of its traditional business and economy-oriented roots, as represented by the Branstad folks, or whether it should focus on social issues the way the Vanderplaats folks argued. So that divide still exists in the Republican Party. But it's weighted heavily toward, at least toward among the activists, those you pointed out, who are more what we would call religious conservatives. In fact, in 2008, sparked by Huckabee, the percentage of self-identified Republicans as evangelicals had been historically around 40%. But exit polls or entrance polls in 2008 showed they were as much as 60%. So that certainly skews the field very differently from what we find among Republicans in New Hampshire, who tend to be more libertarian rather than social or religious conservatives.
And Mike Huckabee, the winner of the 2008 Iowa caucuses, who else do you see as the strongest GOP contenders in Iowa now a little over a year away from caucus date?
Well, Romney still seems to be out there. Romney doesn't get people excited. He certainly didn't get people excited last time around. But Romney would be more of the business-oriented, traditional Republican conservative in the race. Certainly you've got people like Rick Santorum, who's been out about eight times, who's more social and religious conservative. Tim Pawlenty, the outgoing governor of Minnesota, has expressed some interest. So, there's quite a number of folks who are showing up. The concern for those who want to focus the party on economic issues, though, is that, again, they may be so busy fighting amongst each other that they leave a plurality open for Sarah Palin. Although when I say a plurality, remember, again, that this is simply a straw poll at the Republican caucus. Not that different from a straw poll that we'll have next August.
Dennis Goldford with us, Hugh Weinbrenner. They are the authors of the latest edition of their book, The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event, just published in its third edition by University of Iowa Press. And we're winding up our discussion with him in a few more minutes. When we talk about shifting back to talk about Iowa's first in the nation role, you said it got this role in the early 1970s by accident. Over the years, what have been the chief criticism of Iowa's position in this role?
I think the chief criticism has been that Iowa eliminates some candidates before the rest of the nation has an opportunity to comment on them. And some would say that is bad. Some would say that is not all that bad. But Iowa has, as a small state, as certainly one that's not terribly representative politically, and one with the Republican side that is skewed toward evangelicals, may skew the race somewhat. It may give a false impression. But what has happened to alter that dramatically is that the various events have been compressed, and they fall very quickly, one after another, and therefore that original criticism may not be as valid today.
At the same time, I think that while other states have tried to move their primary or caucus events up, making them sooner in the nomination cycle in an attempt to limit the impact of Iowa, in fact, they've increased the impact of Iowa because there's not enough time for a candidate who did poorly to recover or for a candidate who did well to reveal perhaps difficulties or weaknesses in the campaign. So we had jockeying that led us to January 3rd last time. Right now we're set for February 6th of 2012, but already there's talk of various states doing some jockeying.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of a better state than Iowa, perhaps in terms of demographics, to lead off the nomination if we're just sort of thinking out loud?
I don't think that any one state is representative of the country. There have been a variety of suggestions, one of which is to have regional primaries and group the different sectors of the country together. But as Dennis said very early on, until someone comes up with an alternative that the rest of the nation can buy into, it's not going to change.
And that's not any forces or trends in that direction are not anywhere on the horizon.
Not that we can tell. And the difficulty additionally is that our presidential nomination processes are influenced by the national parties in Washington, but the national parties in Washington can't control these. All they can do is try to offer carrots and sticks, but ultimately these are state decisions, state-by-state decisions, on what kind of event to have and when to have it and in what order.
You talked about having a possible alternative, having regions in different primaries. What about a national primary on one single day? If we can imagine that, how would that change this whole campaign process?
Depends how they did it. It depends upon whether you count delegates. In fact, then if they're counted individually, then you'll have candidates who won't show up in Iowa because they'll spend their time in Texas and California and New York and New Jersey and Michigan and Illinois and so forth, where they'll spend their time in the most delegate-rich states.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the major criticism of a national primary is that it emphasizes the strength and power of the big states.
I see. Going back to these three caucuses that you cover in the update of this book, what other lessons, the takeaways, are there from the most recent caucuses? We didn't talk much about the 2004 run. Talk a little bit about that one.
Well, of course, that was the rise and the implosion of the Howard Dean campaign, who did teach some lessons regarding the potential of the internet that the Obama people certainly took and ran with in 2007 and 2008. But you had a case there where you had a quite polarizing or at least incendiary candidate on the Democratic side, and Democratic caucus goers got cold feet toward the end and moved toward people they thought might be more acceptable in the way of Edwards and Kerry. But I think one of the main changes that we've seen, and Hugh was just about the first person to notice this media focus as the core to this when the initial version of the book came out, was that nothing anymore is under the radar. I mean, the crush of media people from not just around the nation but around the world in Iowa is just remarkable, just remarkable. So everything the candidates do, the very fact that we're talking about this now, or this shows up on Politics Wednesday in Iowa Public Radio or on iowapolitics.com and so forth, nothing's under the radar anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So all these candidates have to be very careful about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in a sense, Iowa is a stage, and it's a stage where the national campaign begins and is carried out for the nation.
Is Iowa a good test of organization building for candidates?
Definitely. Historically, and we'll see, as Dennis pointed out, if that has changed. Historically, you had to come in early and identify some supporters and put together a campaign organization. And if you weren't capable of doing that, you didn't do well in a caucus state. We can go all the way back to John Glenn, for example, who everyone thought was going to be a great candidate for the presidency. But he didn't have an organization in Iowa, and Iowa ended his campaign very quickly.
Hugh Weinbrenner, thank you very much for being with us. Dennis Goldford, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on our airwaves. Hugh Weinbrenner and Dennis Goldford, authors of The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event, just published in its third edition by the University of Iowa Press. Hugh Weinbrenner is an emeritus professor of public administration at Drake University. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
Quite welcome.
As hundreds of Iowa soldiers prepare to spend the holidays away from loved ones in support of U.S. military operations abroad, coming up next, I talk with Army Sergeant Dennis Crosser of North Liberty. Crosser is currently deployed in Iraq. He was also deployed in Iraq in his first deployment in 2004. He'll tell us the difference between 2004 and the deployment now when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, a conversation with an Iowan who is part of the remaining troop deployment in Iraq. Sergeant First Class Dennis Crosser is serving his second tour of duty in Iraq. The North Liberty native is an Army reservist with the 103rd Expeditionary Sustained Command out of Des Moines. He's now stationed at Balad Air Force Base just north of Baghdad. I spoke with Sergeant Dennis Crosser by phone and began asking him to describe his work and how it fits into the overall U.S. mission in Iraq.
I work as a circulation control non-commissioned officer, and what I do, my primary job is to monitor the logistical moves throughout Iraq and to provide insight and feedback on how our logistic operations are working to deconflict any issues that our logistic transporters may be having, and also to provide data analysis to my superiors for use in, you know, kind of determining the way ahead for us here in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So during the day, you're working in an office, you're emailing, you're calling, doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. A large part of my job is office work. You know, I get a pretty good overview of what's going on with our transporters here in Iraq. Obviously, communicate with people throughout the country via email and telephone, and ensure that everything we're doing is successful, and help out when there, you know, problems do arise.
Sergeant Crosser, I understand this is your second deployment. You were in Iraq in 04 and 05, correct?
Correct. I came here in 2004 with a transportation unit out of Omaha, Nebraska, and lived in Kuwait, but drove in convoys for a year from Kuwait all over Iraq, delivering supplies and materials for the entire year. What I'm doing this year is quite a bit different than what I did the last time I was here.
So you have different sorts of work. Also, we're hearing here a different environment. When you compare the Iraq then, 5 years ago, during your first deployment, to the Iraq now, how has that environment changed?
Well, in addition to the work that I do on a daily basis, I also have an additional job here on the protective services detail. So myself and some of the other people in the unit do get the occasional opportunity to go outside the wire and go to some of the other bases here in Iraq. And, you know, that allows me to kind of compare and contrast to what I saw when I was here last time. What I see this time is the Iraqi people seem to be, at least in my opinion, a lot more comfortable with our presence. When I was here before, it seemed that, you know, our convoys moving throughout Iraq were sometimes perceived negatively by the populace. And what I'm seeing this time when I get out on the roads is that the people that are out there, the relationship between our military here and the Iraqis seems to have improved a great deal, probably partially attributed to the fact that we've just been here for a little while. And also, I think, due to the fact that, you know, as a fighting force, we've gotten better and more comfortable with what we're doing, and we're polite and professional with the Iraqis, to the point that I think that they understand what we're doing here and appreciate the fact that we're making an effort to have as little a footprint as possible when we're using their roads and out in our country.
When you say that you've noticed this difference in the Iraqi attitudes and behavior, specifically, what does that mean? Do you come into contact with them, speak with them through a translator? I'm trying to get a picture as, you know, if you're driving a convoy, does it mean people are greeting you with smiles? Are they saying things to you? What is the interaction that leads you to believe that there has been a sea change in the Iraqi population's attitudes towards the U.S. military there?
Well, you know, I don't have an opportunity to specifically speak with them through an interpreter. What I mean is when I was here in 04, you know, there was it was early on with American forces being here, and the relationship had not really been truly established, I don't think. And so when we were out on the roads then, at least in the job that I did, you know, driving in convoy, logistical convoys throughout the country, you know, it seemed that the Iraqis didn't necessarily know what to do when we were around. And as soldiers, you know, we weren't involved in talking to them daily. We just saw them as we drove down the road. So, you know, we were a little tentative of them being out there. We had a job to do, and, you know, we had our protocol in terms of what we were supposed to be doing. So, you know, there was a standoffish relationship in terms of, I think they just didn't really want to necessarily be around us too much, and we just wanted, you know, to kind of get past them on our way up the highways. And now what I'm seeing is the American forces that I see out there now, that relationship has been better established, and I think that the military has done a better job trying to basically be polite and professional, and we understand better now that, you know, this is the Iraqis' country, and so when we're out on the roads, you know, we try to act as guests in their country. We're close to them now, and we share the roads with them now, and they seem much more comfortable with that. They don't seem to shy away from us. And when we're out there, I think that the training that I've gotten and the technology that we have available to us, I think that the soldiers that I work with and myself are a lot more comfortable when we're out on the roads and sharing the roads with the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm. You say you behave as guests in their country, and how much of a difference has it made that the U.S. has begun the drawdown, giving back command over the forces to the Iraqi forces? Because before, it was the Iraqis, maybe with good reason, or they didn't know, thought that we were permanent occupiers. How much of a difference does that make that they see not only in word, but in deed, we are leaving?
You know, from my perspective, I mean, we certainly are trained to understand and to act in such a manner that we demonstrate to the Iraqis when we're outside the wire that this is their country, and we go out of our way to make sure that we are not, you know, doing things that would suggest that we're free to act as we please. So I would like to think that the Iraqi people see that, and, you know, based on how I see them act when we're out there now versus when I was here in 2004, I think they get that. And whether that's because they get that because we act different or because they know we're leaving, you know, that, not sure which one would take precedence there, but I hope they definitely can see that, you know, we act with their needs and we're mindful of how the Iraqis will perceive us when we're outside the wire.
What signs of insurgent violence remain?
Well, certainly from reading the paper and looking at the news, you know, there is still some violence going on here in Iraq. I can't say that I've seen that personally when I've been on missions, but, you know, there certainly is still an element here in Iraq that is not happy with us being here, regardless of when we're leaving. And I think that, you know, anybody could read that in the newspaper or on the internet and see that it still exists.
Yeah, but being on the ground there and driving convoys through the population, do you get a sense that that is a fringe, a small element, or still a sizable part of the Iraqi population?
You know, from my perspective and what I've seen, I really couldn't speculate on, you know, how large of a group that is. I know that, again, I have not seen that since I've been here. I know that another thing that's a lot different this time, it kind of goes back to your previous question, but the relationship between ourselves and the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army is much improved now than it was when I was here in 2004.
Describe how that relationship has changed with the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army.
Well, their presence, there's a much more significant presence now than there was previously. And, you know, we have worked with them as a military long enough that the trust and respect level is significantly higher than it was when I was here before. So there's an expectation that we have worked with them and are working with them so that they can, you know, provide security for their country. You know, we have, although we don't necessarily have to interact with them every time we leave, we certainly have protocol that we follow that allows us to interact with them in such a way that they know what we're doing and we know what they're doing.
When you go outside the wire, as you say, and that's outside of your base, what type of security or extra safety measures do you need to take?
Certainly, can't get into too much detail, but, you know, the United States has certainly learned a lot since we've been here and done a very good job of ensuring that we have the proper vehicles and the proper equipment necessary to be as safe as possible when we do go to other bases. Certainly those that are involved in doing that receive the training that they would need to be part of a group that is going outside the wire. Mm-hmm. So without really going into a lot of detail, that's probably the best way I could sum it up, is that, you know, compared to, and I'll compare it back to 2004, the training and the technology that we have now makes that job a lot safer than it used to be, I believe.
I know for security purposes you can't go into detail in some of these things, but would you be able to say what you believe the biggest risk currently to troops is in the Iraqi theater? Is it still the IEDs, the roadside bombs?
Yeah, I would say that that the IEDs are probably still the most significant risk that we would face when we go outside the wire. It's certainly not as significant of a risk as it has been previously, but that's probably still the most significant risk we face, yes.
In this deployment or your previous deployment in 04 and 05, did you lose any members of your unit?
You know, I've been extremely fortunate in that perspective. I've had some people that I've worked with who have gotten hurt, but it's been, accident situations, and not a lot of them. I have not had any friends or anybody close to me that's really been injured or anything else due to enemy activity.
If you've just joined us, we're talking by phone from Iraq with Sergeant First Class Dennis Crosser of the 103rd Expeditionary Sustained Force Command, based at Balad Air Base. That's just north of Baghdad. This is Sergeant Crosser's second deployment. He served in 04 and 05 in Iraq. His hometown is North Liberty. And, Sergeant, I understand that your grandfather served in the Second World War.
Yes, he did. My grandfather, Mac Thornis, lives in Marshalltown, Iowa, and he was part of the occupation force in Japan at the end of World War II.
And he's still around?
Yes, he is. 83, 84, I probably should know exactly, but I think I'm in the right range there.
Well, he's certainly going to want to tune in to this and is probably listening. Did the fact that your grandfather served in World War II have any influence on you joining the military?
You know, my decision to join the military was really kind of twofold. The GI Bill certainly was a factor. I went to the University of Iowa, and the GI Bill was available to help with college. And, despite the fact that my grandfather's really the only person from my family who's been in the military, close family member, I really just felt that serving in the armed forces was something that I should do, that everybody should do. And I'd like to give my grandfather credit, but, to be honest with you, him and myself have spent a lot more time talking about the military since I joined than before I joined. So I'm proud that he served, and I know he's proud of me, and we spend a good deal of time talking about it.
Uh-huh. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the interaction you have with your grandfather or your family back here in Iowa. How often do you get to chat with folks back here?
For myself, living at a large base here at Balad, we have phones and internet that are available, basically on a daily basis. I know some of the folks that live in the smaller bases may not have as much access, but in terms of phone and internet, it's pretty readily available for any of the soldiers to have an opportunity to speak with their families back home. I am married, and so majority of my communication goes back straight to the wife. I really, when I was here last time, it was really better for me just to kind of focus on what I was doing. So I call the wife and email out updates to the entire family, and that's pretty much readily available to all the soldiers here.
Mm-hmm. What information do they, your family, your loved ones, seem most interested in?
They're certainly interested in hearing about, what we're doing over here, and I think they really enjoy the pictures the most. For myself, I'm not a young kid, and this is the second time I've been here, so I think my family's a little more comfortable with it this time than when I was in here in 04. I think then they just wanted to hear that I was all right as often as I could tell them. But, I think that they enjoy hearing the stories that I can tell them, and I think especially the pictures.
We're very sorry that you won't be part of the Christmas picture here in Iowa this year, and I'm sure you're missing that part of the season here. What will you miss most about not spending the holidays in the U.S.?
My family lives throughout Iowa, and so the opportunities to get together with the entire family are, typically relegated to the holiday season. So I'm going to miss the chance to get together with all my friends and family over the holiday season. But I will be coming home on leave before too much longer, so I'm going to have an opportunity to kind of make it up. And
right. Do some serious catching up when you get back stateside.
Exactly.
Now, what are you doing there for the holidays at your base, at the air base, Balad Air Base, north of Baghdad?
Well, you know what, I think we're all crossing our fingers hoping that we get a little extra time off that day as part of the celebration. But, you know, the military does do a really good job with the holiday meal. That's the big focus here. So we had a really nice Thanksgiving, and if I was to bet, I'd say the menu is going to look pretty similar for Christmas. So probably what I'm looking forward to over here is a really nice lunch that day. To be honest, the food's not that bad most of the time anyway, so I can't complain on that. But we'll have a real nice meal, and I know we're gonna, you know, we'll all get together with the people we're close with over here and just enjoy the holidays.
You have such an interesting perspective, Sergeant Crosser, because you were in 04 and 05, you were deployed in Iraq as well. And you mentioned this earlier, but can you talk again or elaborate on how the U.S. military has learned throughout this deployment, not only in, you know, making the servicemen and women in Iraq feel at home, but also so that they're more effective in their deployment?
Well, I think one of the things that the military has benefited from the most from us being here in Iraq and certainly the soldiers that have gone to Afghanistan is, you know, we have a very experienced group of people now in our military. And I've been in the Army Reserves for 20 years. And, you know, for the first 10 to 12 years of that time, you saw the combat patches for Desert Storm. And, you know, when I first joined, even from Vietnam, but now a lot of the people, you know, are experienced and have been here before, so that they're able to provide training and mentorship to the soldiers that haven't. Certainly, the role that the United States military has played here in Iraq has, you know, somewhat changed as we've been here, and we've had to battle different problems throughout the time we've been here. So I think from a techniques and tactics perspective, we've learned some things or been reminded of some things that would be most effective in helping out the Iraqi government here. And so, of course, those things are passed on to the people coming over here through training prior to coming here and then reinforced once you're here. And then, you know, one of the biggest things is from a technology perspective, you know, money has been spent on the equipment that improves the survivability and effectiveness of the soldiers that come here. So that's definitely a big change from when I was here in 04 and 05.
Sergeant Crosser, when does your deployment end? When are you back in the U.S.?
We should be home by this summer. That's the plan. So I should be able to spend the summer in Iowa and do a little catching up with the family.
Do you get some time off or go immediately back to your civilian job?
You know, that's one nice thing is, you know, we are able to take a little bit of time off before we go back to work. So I'm hoping I'll get at least, 2 months or so to kind of get caught back up with everything that's going on and kind of reset myself so I'm ready to go back to my civilian job. Being in a reserve unit, you know, that's everybody that's here has something different that they're going back to. And so we do get a little time off to kind of catch up with friends and family and kind of regroup for going back to that lifestyle.
Of course, eager to get back to Iowa, to your regular life, to your wife and other loved ones here. But when you do come back, have you thought about already, when this is all done, the Iraq theater, the drawing down is done, U.S. military is out of Iraq, you will not have to go back. Do you ever think about what you will most miss about the experience that you're having now?
Well, you know, my wife and I just got married last December, so you know, this is really gonna kind of be what we're used to in terms of being a married couple. I've been gone the majority of the time that we've been married, so I'm looking forward to getting back with Lori, my wife, and starting our life together. I think it's gonna be definitely different when I'm not gone and not dealing with the training that's necessary to ramp up for something like this. You know, I know one thing my wife mentioned to me is she said that if every couple of years I have to leave for a year, it might make for a happy marriage, but I think she was joking on that.
All right. We want to thank you very much, Sergeant Crosser, for this conversation. It's been great to hear your voice and have you give us a picture of what you and hundreds of other servicemen and women from Iowa are experiencing in Iraq over this holiday season. Would you like to end up by saying any last things to those of us in Iowa, your loved ones?
Yeah, I just want to say thanks for taking the time to let me speak with you. Say hello to my wife, Lori, and my dog, Cleo, and the family, and go Hawkeyes. Can't wait to be back next fall so I can do some tailgating and cheer for the Hawkeyes, and maybe we'll have a better year.
Sergeant Dennis Crosser, thank you so much. Keep safe, sir, and we'll look forward to having you back in the summer.
All right, thanks a lot.
Sergeant Dennis Crosser, a native of North Liberty, serving his second tour of duty in Iraq, part of the 103rd Expeditionary Sustained Command out of Des Moines. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.